February 14, 2007. Open a public hearing on House Bill 5043, the Department of State Lands. And we will. Do you want to start with anything?
I have no opening comments.
Okay. Ms. Soliday, the floor is yours.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Louise Soliday, Director of the Department of State Lands. Behind me is a battalion of DSL staff who will bail me out if I need it over the course of the next couple of days. And I've got a PowerPoint presentation, which you've got a copy of in front of you, and I'm pretty much going to follow the order of the budget presentation notebook that you have in front of you also. And I just want to start by showing a map of the Common School Fund lands, the real estate portfolio that are part of the Common School Fund, which the Department of State Land manages. And this directs a lot of our activities in the agency. Anything that you see in the purple up there on that map are lands that we own, the biggest portions of those, the Elliott State Forest over in Coos County, and blocked rangelands in southeast Oregon. And then the blue lines are the waterways that we own, the territorial sea, and then all of the rivers that are either tidally influenced or have had navigability determinations made on them. So in terms of the landscape that we manage throughout Oregon, it's quite diverse, and we own land in every county in the state. Over the course of the next couple of days, I'm going to sort of run through four major topic areas. First, I want to talk about the budget drivers, the things that we took into consideration as we were developing our budget last year. Talk about our performance measures. We had considerable changes that were made in the interim with our interface with the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. Talk about our budget priorities, reductions, and our efficiencies, and then talk about our program option packages and the connection of those to our key performance measures. First, in terms of budget drivers, the Department of State Lands had three overall themes that they used as that we used as we were developing the budget. We wanted to enhance and protect the Common School Fund. That fund is managed for the benefit of current and future school children. It includes both a real estate portfolio, the map that I showed you, and a financial portfolio. The financial portfolio is valued at just over $1.1 billion right now. The real estate portfolio is valued between $650 million and $900 million conservatively. In 2001, as you all know, the state faced a budget crisis which continued into the 2003-2005 biennium, and the State Land Board and the Department, as a result of that crisis, looked at ways that it could increase revenues into the Common School Fund for the benefit of the 198 school districts. And as a result of that, the Land Board adopted a new distribution policy to try and smooth out those distributions so that school districts could predict with some accuracy the amounts of money that they would be getting from the Common School Fund twice annually. We adopted a new asset management plan, which I'll talk about in a little bit more detail in a second. And we looked at ways that we could grow the unclaimed property in the estates program, both of which generate revenues in the Common School Fund. Secondly, we have responsibility to conserve and protect natural resources, and that's our regulatory programs, managing wetlands and waterways in the state of Oregon. Those programs go back to the 1960s in the case of the removal fill program, and the wetlands program back to 1989 with the passage of the Wetlands Conservation Act. And then third major theme for us was how do we improve customer service, and that's both internally and externally. And we've been looking at ways that we can improve customer service, from very simple things like returning emails and voicemails in a timely manner to looking at how we can automate more of our services, how we can streamline our permitting and leasing processes, and some basic communication mechanisms to keep our constituents informed about what we're doing and get feedback from them. Our key performance measures, we also took a hard look at those as we were putting together our budget, and they were a fairly fluid thing as we were putting our budget together. When we came out of the 2005 legislative session, we had 29 performance measures. Several of those had been added by the 2005 legislature, but we were also direct to look at ways to reduce the numbers of key performance measures, and so we worked in the interim with the Joint Legislative Audit Committee to reduce the number, and we have reduced them from 29 to 18, and as a part of our budget, we're going to actually propose to reduce them by one more. Our key performance measures now cover all of our major program areas, and they are directly related to things that DSL's activities have an impact on, and they're very helpful to us for our program planning. We also have a number of agency plans that we have put in place. We have a brand new strategic plan that we adopted, the land board adopted in October of 2006, which is an update from our previous one. We have a brand new 10-year asset management plan. We adopted the first asset management plan in 1995, and when the land board adopted a new plan in 2006. And this plan is really a core to what the Land Management Division in the department does. This new 10-year plan calls for a number of things. First of all, we want to retain our core assets that are in our land base, and that includes assets like the Elliott State Forest, our block rangelands, our submerged and submersible waterways. But the plan also identifies a number of parcels for sale, both rangelands and forest lands and agricultural lands that are not currently under lease, not producing revenue, have some expenses associated with managing those. We believe that in many cases those lands would be better served if they were back in the private sector. And so there are about 25,000 acres in our real estate portfolio that we have identified for potential disposal over the 10-year time period of this plan. The plan also calls for us to complete our in-lieu land selections, and just to remind everybody, when Oregon became a state, we were awarded the 16th and 36th section of every township for the purposes of financing a public education system. And in 1859, when Oregon became a state, some of those sections had already been settled by others, and so the state was to receive lands in lieu of those 16th and 36th sections. We are still trying to get all of the lands that we were due at statehood. We had to go to court against the federal government in the late 1980s, and in 1991, the courts determined that we were owed another 5,202 acres to make us whole for the acreage that we were supposed to get back in 1859. We are down to about 3,400 acres that we are still owed. We have selected a number of parcels from the BLM's land inventory, particularly in Central Oregon, and we are continuing to work with them to get those lands. And I think, as I told you in our agency overview, my goal is to actually get those by 2009 when we're celebrating our sesquicentennial. So hopefully we will have all of those. We do expect about another 1,000 or 1,100 acres to actually come to us this year, and that involves a large parcel just south of Redmond, a small parcel in Klein Buttes, and some smaller parcels in the Roseburg District. And then finally, this new asset management plan calls for us to invest our monies that we have in our land revolving fund into land assets that have the potential to generate more revenues than the current land holdings that we have. And that means investing in lands that have industrial, commercial, and residential potential. And many of our in-lieu land selections that we've made in Central Oregon are exactly for that purpose. They are lands that are on the fringes of urban growth boundaries in the Bend-Redmond area. And so we think they have huge potential to provide ongoing revenue to the Department of State Lands over time as we develop those, probably in partnership with private developers, into industrial, commercial, and residential opportunities. Let's go back here. Sorry. We also have sustainability plan. Even though we were not in the first governor's sustainability executive order, we chose to do a plan, and we have actually updated that plan last year. to add some critical components involved in looking at using our lands for development of renewable energy resources, building into our industrial, commercial, and residential developments sustainability criteria to be used for the buildings that are built on those lands, and for management of those lands as well. We also added a piece that we've been working towards over a number of years, and that is to continue to work towards having a paperless file system so that all our files are online, available electronically to the public and to our staff, particularly when they're out in the field. And we've got some option package information that we'll talk about when we get to that part of the presentation. We also have a wetlands conservation strategy plan that was adopted back in 1995. It directs how we are going to engage in both our regulatory and our voluntary wetlands program in order to meet the state policy goal of no net loss of wetlands in the state of Oregon. The South Slough, which is National Estuarine Research Reserve, which is a program in which the state, the Department of State Lands serves as the state partner, has adopted a new five-year management plan last year, and that directs how they are going to implement their education, research, stewardship, and monitoring programs within the confines of that 4,770-acre research reserve in Charleston. And then last, we have a Lower Willamette Management Plan, and that plan directs both our proprietary and regulatory responsibilities in the first 17 and a half miles of the Lower Willamette River. This plan has been used many times by us to make decisions about whether we would sell or lease submerged and submersible lands in the Lower Willamette. It will be used as we're working on the Superfund, Portland Harbor Superfund site cleanup over the next several years as well. And so that's another document that we use as we're thinking about our budget. We also have a number of streamlining initiatives that we have been working on, and we have some budget packages that are related to this. In the permitting area, we have been looking at trying some things and looking at doing some other things. I think, as most of you know, we tried a streamlining effort last year called the SPGP, or State Programmatic General Permit. We were attempting to fold into the Department of State Lands removal fill permits the federal authorizations from the Corps and the ES Endangered Species Act consultations that come with the Corps 404 permits. That permit did not work as we intended it to, and so it was suspended in October of last year. We are still continuing to work with the Corps and the services and EPA and DEQ and DLCD, who does the Coastal Zone Management Act consistency determinations, to see if we can redesign that permit or that effort in a way that is going to work for our applicants and for the agency. We also have a project that we've been working on in the interim as a result of a 2005 budget note that we received along with six other state agencies directing us to work together to figure out how we might better integrate state authorizations and state permits in waters of the state. We've been working with those agencies in the interim through an effort called RIPIT, which is the Water-Related Permit Process Improvement Team. And we are proposing a pilot project for the next biennium to actually test a process that we have come up with where we think we can integrate up to 11 state authorizations or permits into a single process. And the Department of State Lands would be the one-stop shop, the door that people would come in to get all of those authorizations. And we also have some other streamlining efforts that we are working on, including looking at going to notification-based authorizations for removal fill activities that have minimal impacts out on the landscape, as well as looking at continuing to look at ways that we can improve our permitting process. We're also looking to get authorization from the legislature to put another tool in our toolbox, and that would be allow us to issue a general permit for the same kinds of activities that are repeated around the state or within a certain geographic area instead of having to issue individual permits for those activities. So a number of permitting streamlining activities. We also have a number of streamlining activities we've been moving towards in the e-commerce area. We've already moved our placer mining permitting completely online. So if you want to engage in placer mining that has minimal impacts around the state of Oregon, you can go online and you can fill out a form very quickly and get instant authorization to engage in placer mining activities. We're looking at how we can get other authorizations online through an automated system. We're also looking at how to begin to accept credit card payments for lease payments, for permit fees, all of the revenues that we take in. And as I mentioned earlier, we are looking to move to a paperless file system. We are taking up a huge amount of floor space in our offices with file rooms and files all over the place. And so we are looking to get all of those on an electronic system and accessible to everybody. We have a couple of critical issues that we also considered. The Portland Harbor Superfund site was listed a few years ago. It is about a 6.5-mile area in right in downtown Portland. The Department of State Lands is the owner of the submerged and submersible lands throughout that Superfund site. We have historically leased those submerged and submersible lands to a variety of companies over a number of years, some who may or may not have contributed to the pollution that is in the harbor. We also have regulatory responsibilities for the cleanup. Many of the actions that are likely to be implemented in the cleanup will involve putting sediment caps on our lands, may involve other recovery actions that may involve the Department of State Lands real estate assets that we have in the Superfund site. We did sign a tolling agreement with the Lower Willamette Group this past year, which says that we're not going to sue each other while we continue to work together on the feasibility study and remedial investigation, which is the study that's done to try and quantify and qualify what the contaminants are in the harbor and in what quantity they are, where they are located, and then also to develop a number of alternatives for how to clean up those contaminants over a period of time. As it stands right now, the Environmental Protection Agency is looking at a record of decision in 2008, although I would not be surprised to see that record of decision deadline push out maybe 2, maybe as much as 4 years, given that they are still trying to assess the contaminants that are in the harbor and where they are. So that's an area where the timing is a little up in the air at the moment, and we'll see as that moves forward. But given DSL's major responsibilities, both in terms of the proprietary lands that we hold and our regulatory responsibilities there, we will be a major player in any cleanup effort that takes place. We've already worked with a number of companies on early actions that have been implemented in the harbor, and in some cases we have sold land to them to use for sediment caps. In some cases we have leased lands, and we have the potential for a number of other early actions that could come over the next year or two. And then the second one is where the unclaimed property section, which is currently housed at the Department of State Lands, should reside. There is a Senate Bill 67, which proposes to transfer the program from the Department of State Lands to the Office of the State Treasurer. That bill has been heard in the Substantive Committee in the Senate, and I believe is somewhere in the Ways and Means process. Okay. And so I expect you'll be having some conversations about that. our program option package that's tied to that is 105, and for us it would reduce our staff by 12 FTE, which is all of the staff that are in the unclaimed property section, and relocate those folks in the treasurer's office. That bill was introduced at the request of the land board by the governor. The land board has unanimously voted to support the move, and there are a number of reasons why that's being recommended. I think first and foremost, people believe that the program will have a higher profile in the treasurer's office, and as a result, we will have increased holdings and increased claim activity by it being in the treasurer's office. In most states, it is in the treasurer's office, and it's probably the logical place where someone would call if they were trying to find an old bank account, as opposed to the Department of State Land. So, and I expect there'll be quite a bit of discussion about doing that. There are some increased costs in the treasurer's office. Probably the most obvious of those is because we own our own office building as an asset of the Common School Fund, we do not pay rent for those staff, and the treasurer's office would be paying rent. And I believe also for many of the positions that we have, their salaries are a bit higher than ours are at the Department of State Lands. We also have looked at how we recover more of our costs. Over the last several years, in fact, since 1989, which is the last time we had a fee increase in our removal fill program, the burden of paying for the cost of a regulatory program has shifted off of fees and onto the Common School Fund. So we have looked at how do we begin to reduce the burden on the Common School Fund of our regulatory programs, our wetlands and waterway program. We have done a couple of things. We have applied for some federal grants as we've looked at how we can expand that program without putting additional costs on the Common School Fund, and we've been successful in getting a couple of federal grants to help out. But we also have two fee bills that are in this legislative session, which are House Bill 2105 and 2106. House Bill 2105 is our general removal fill fees, and we've proposed increases on the order of about 70%. And just to put in perspective, in 1989, which was the last time we had a fee increase, fees covered 50% of the cost of the removal fill program. Last year, they covered 9.6% of the program. So we are seriously out of balance in terms of fees covering the cost of that regulatory program. In fact, if you go back to 1967, when the program was first initiated, there was actually a discussion about how much should be paid for out of the Common School Fund versus fees. And at that time, a decision was made that the fees should cover 65% of the program, Common School Fund 35%. And the justification for using Common School Fund resources to pay for part of the program is we do own the submerged and submersible lands in many places, and so there's a benefit to some of the real estate that we manage from having the removal fill program. But at this point, with fees picking up just 9.6% of the program, I think we're looking at how do we get things better in balance in terms of how much the Common School Fund is contributing and how much our fees are contributing. And we also get very few general funds, but we do have general funds that cover the economic revitalization team staff person that we have, and we have one general fund request package, and that's for our this RIPET streamlining effort, which is an interagency, and as a result did not feel that the Common School Fund should bear the burden of the cost of that program, given that it involved multiple agencies. And then we have three bills that are directly related to legislation, three bills that are directly related to our budget. The first one is the one I just mentioned, and that's Senate Bill 67, which moves the unclaimed property section to the Office of the State Treasurer, and that's our program option package 105. And House Bill 2106, which would establish a new fee for wetland delineation reviews to get us additional staff. We have a serious backlog in that program in terms of wetland delineation reviews. We are, in some cases, holding up development, in some cases making developers go back and redesign because of the delays in our work to get those reviews done. The new fee would raise enough money to support two additional FTE in that program. As a part of that, we would guarantee that those reviews would be done within a 120-day time frame, so we would provide certainty to developers and other applicants that they would get those delineation reviews in a timely manner. And then the third bill that has a direct connection to our budget is House Bill 2251, and this is the bill that would implement the RIPET pilot project that I talked about earlier. And it has a budget package that involves one FTE and some resources to help with some of the automated computer work that we want to do in that program. And then last but not least, we also took into consideration the governor's priorities, and of his six priorities, five of them have some connection to our budget, and that includes certainly the first and foremost the education piece, economy and jobs, the environment, sustainability, energy independence, public safety, and also government accountability and efficiencies.
At this point, we will go to Ms. Holliday. We will go to some questions.
Great.
I know that there are a number of questions here. I'll start off with Representative Girard, and even though she hasn't raised her hand, I will go to Representative Dingfelter after that, because I think she's got 14 questions here.
Only three.
So, Representative Girard.
I only have three. I appreciate that. Good morning, Louise.
Good morning.
A couple of definitions for me. Where exactly is the lower Willamette River?
Mr. Chair and Representative Girard, it starts from Kelly Point, where the Willamette River flows into the Columbia and runs 17.5 miles upriver to it's just north of, just above one of the bridges,
Ross Island.
Ross Island.
Second question, Mr. Chair. What is a sediment cap?
Mr. Chair and Representative Girard, in Superfund cleanups and other cleanup efforts, sometimes a decision is made to leave the contamination in place and to place a cap on top of it and a berm around it to contain the sediment, the contaminants in the sediment where it is. And in many cases, the sediment cap will come right up and go equal the landscape, and you can actually use the land above it for economic uses.
And my third one, Mr. Chair, is, Louise, I realize you didn't take over this agency until last summer, so I can't hold you responsible, but I wish our agencies would think more before they go for a 70% increase in fees. I'd much rather see a 5 or 10% increase every biennium versus jumping up 70% in one shot.
Mr. Chair and Representative Girard, I would agree wholeheartedly, and had we been able to convince the legislature to approve past fee bills, we wouldn't be in this position.
Well, you threw that one right back.
You're setting us up like that.
Work right here in my nose. That hurt. That'll teach me to ask questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm done.
Mr. Chair, I might also add that one of the things we've done in our fee bills is built in an automatic CPI increase so that we don't get in this problem again and that we increase them a little bit each year.
I might comment for the committee, looking over the budgets that we have some, a few, that are relatively modest increases, but we have a number of agencies that are coming forward because of the same issue that you have cited to some extent, with relatively dramatic increases in fees. I looked at your fee schedule on your website, and quite honestly, compared to the fees that I know that the development community pays now for a whole lot of other things, they seem very inexpensive compared to what they were actually evaluating. But I do think we need to find some way that fees keep some relationship. And we've had this discussion already in the committee that we really do not have a clear basis for how fees are set for what the public and private benefit is of fees. Every time, like someone here on the committee says that, fees should be split evenly when they're like this fee. That's like 9% and going to, I think, 17% or something like that. I believe that there are other interests in this building listening to that discussion who actually only want to pay 50% or 75% of their fee and are looking for a general fund backfill for that fee, so which will be another agency that we will be discussing later. So, Representative Dingfelter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also have three questions relating to cost recovery, Louise. And the first one is actually with the Superfund program, and I worked in the Superfund program for 4 years, so somewhat familiar, too familiar with sediment caps, actually. But the question I have is, can you do any cost recovery with the potentially responsible parties?
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative Dingfelter, I think the answer to that may be yes. One of the things that... when we entered into our tolling agreement with the Lower Willamette Group, one of the things we indicated in that agreement is there is potential for us to use the lands that we have as sort of our contribution to the cleanup. So we are looking at doing that. In terms of cost recovery, because we are the owner of lands that were leased to people who may have contributed to the contamination, I think some folks are looking to us to actually, as a potentially responsible party, would contribute to the costs, paying the costs, as opposed to us recovering costs.
Follow up on that. So I understand that you own the lands, but they were leased to people who caused the contamination. So the question is, are there activities, or through our AG's office, to try to go after some of those folks?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dingfelter, yes. We are doing in the process of doing site histories for each of our all of the property that we own there. Some of that is not easy to track down. Some of those leases are long gone from our records, go back many years, but we have been working very closely with the AG's office and the Department of Environmental Quality and other state agencies, as well as the federal agencies, to try and identify our lands, try and identify contributions to the contaminants there that may have come from our lands under leases that we had with folks.
And I have two other quick questions all relating to cost recovery. And one is I sat on the audits committee last session, and that was, I think, before you with the agency, but I'm pretty sure there was recently an audit done on rangelands, on the fee charge for rangelands. Do you know when the last time an audit was done on the fee charge for submersible, for structures on submersible lands? I mean, we have, hundreds if not thousands of structures that pay fees to the state, and it was very interesting to look at the audit from the rangelands and certainly to see that we were way undercharging what, the fair market value. So I'm curious as to when the last audit was conducted of those license fees.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dingfelter, to the knowledge of the person who's been around the longest in the agency, there hasn't been one.
And then last but not least, you had mentioned that there were several swaps and then selling of property, and I think there were three different, you're looking at swaps, selling of property, and then maybe, some additional leases. So could you... I read through this weekend, but I don't recall if in there you list how much additional funds would be added to the Common School Fund through those sales over time.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dingfelter, we estimate if we sell all 25,000 acres that are identified for disposal, it has the potential to bring in $20 to $25 million over the next 10 years.
Thank you. That's it.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Well, Jim, what are your costs? Do you have a list of those? I mean, do you put down a...
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, in terms of what's the cost of the the total cost of the regulatory program? Is that what you're asking?
Saying you
or
must
the
a,
fees?
You must have a list of, okay, you pay attorney's fees, you pay lights, you pay, what are your costs? Why does it cost so much to do? Where are you spending your money, basically? That's what I'm asking.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, in the Wetlands and Waterways Division, we have 32 staff people who work on processing permits and doing wetland reviews. The costs for this biennium are, $4.1 million for that program. And that's the cost of salary, AG costs, all the normal costs that you would have with a staff of that size, travel, training.
We're one of the things we're going to be faced with is this raise in attorney's fees from $111 to $128. How much will that affect your budget?
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, I'd have to go look at the AG charges in the 07-09 budget document.
I don't need that right now, but
okay.
I'm just
thinking. We can talk about that.
That's something out there that we're going to have to be faced with, because as I understand it, that omnibus bill at the very end is going to make a determination on how much we raise those attorney's fees if we raise them all. Is that correct?
And Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, when we get to the efficiencies part, our AG's costs are one of the areas where we're looking to provide some efficiencies, and I'll talk about that when we get to that portion of the budget discussion.
Senator Nelson, I actually am privy to a little bit of that discussion and in previous sessions, too, is that I compare the AG, who happens to be a friend of mine, a little bit to like the judicial branch. They come in and request A, knowing that they're going to get B.
And 2% or whatever.
But I expect that number will be brought down somewhat. I had a few questions. If there's something you want to respond to, go ahead and respond to Ms. Holliday, and then I had a few questions. Please go ahead and respond if there was something you wanted to respond to.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, in terms of our AG costs, our 2005-07 estimates were $927,574. Our agency request, the governor's recommended same amount is $1.2 million,
$1,288,733. $1,000 increase under the governor's budget.
Thank you.
Yes.
Does that include the policy option package?
It does not.
Okay.
Ms. Soliday, couple of items. One, could you comment, even though it's prior to your time, on the rangeland audit? I happened to be on the committee that was considering that, and there was a very lengthy discussion. And sometimes when audits are done by the Secretary of State's office, they have relatively well-found conclusions. Sometimes they don't have as well-found conclusions. And one of the things that we saw was that the estimates in that audit were basically putting a price on rangelands in terms of their lease that was at the optimum sort of price for the market and not necessarily at a realistic price for where the rangelands were or what their potential use was or what their how much water was even available on the rangelands and a lot of other associated issues.
Mr. Chair, just so everybody knows where this information is, if you look in the major governor's recommended budget on page 477, which is in the special reports section.
The weightlifting.
You will see our response to the rangeland audit followed by the audit report that was done by the Secretary of State's auditors. And a couple of things. The audit raised a number of issues, some of which we agreed with and some of which we did not. And I think there are a number of things you have to take into consideration when you're looking at our lease rates for rangelands. In many cases, the rangelands that we're leasing are unimproved rangelands. They don't have water, they don't have fences, they don't, you know, they're pretty much ground with forage on them. In many cases, those who lease lands, private landowners who lease lands, have made improvements to those lands, and those affect the lease rates that they are able to get for those lands. Our lease rates tend to be quite a bit above the federal land lease rates, but below the private lease rates. We have a formula that we use to establish lease rates for our rangelands. That formula right now for 2007, the lease rate is $5.80 per animal unit month. Last year it was $5.60. The federal government just announced that under their formula, their lease rates are going down in 2007, while ours went up a little bit. We do not have good information on private lease rates. The Secretary of State's Audits Division used some information that was gleaned from a survey that the Natural Resources Conservation Service does of lessees and people who own rangelands around the state, in which a question is posed about what you think private land lease rates are. And so it's not what we believe to be very good data in terms of knowing what the actual lease rates are for private lands. And one of the things that we've committed to do we put together a grazing fee advisory committee to look at this issue. And one of the recommendations that came out of that was that we look and see if we can actually get data from actual private land lease rates for the Southeast Oregon area, which is where we have all of our lease rangelands, to get a better comparison of those lands. We've also agreed that we will come back and revisit the grazing fee formula and the fees, the rates in 2008. We've also, one of the recommendations that the committee made to us is that we raise our minimum rate to make sure that it's enough to cover our costs for that program. So we've done a number of things to respond to that audit and are continuing to do that. But I think sometimes when you're looking at rangelands, there's a tendency to compare apples and oranges and not apples and apples.
Representative Dinkfelter has a follow-up to that, and then I have another question.
Louise, I see I'm looking at the response right now, and you mentioned many of the western states. So did we look at what those western states compare? Because it seems like we should be looking what other states charge versus what private landowners charge.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Dingfelder, we did look at other states, and we are right in the middle of the pack.
Ask another question.
Mr. Chair had a question. Okay, Senator Vakian.
I don't know what that means relative to whether it's where we should be or not.
Mr. Chair and Madam Chair and Senator Vakian, I was just looking to see if we've got the other state rates in our...
I didn't see it.
Well, and I guess implicit in my question is oftentimes looking at other states as comparators is not very helpful to me because I don't know whether or not what they're charging is an appropriate rate. And so it's hard to gauge what the standard should be, so I guess maybe a little more explanation from you on whether or not you're comfortable with us being in that middle range and why.
Mr. Chair and Senator Avakian, I guess I'm comfortable for the moment. As I said, we've made a commitment that we're going to revisit this issue in 2008, and we're in the process of putting together some of the data we need to go into that discussion next year. As we were looking at other states who have common school fund lands, just as we do, what they are charging for their leasing rates, some of them are $6 or $7 or $8 an animal unit. Some of them are $4, $3, and $2. And that's why I say we're sort of in the middle of the pack of the states that we compare ourselves to. Whether it's the right amount of money, I think that's hard to tell. Once again, you have to really know what the amenities, the improvements are in those rangelands to really be able to get a handle on what's the fair market value lease rate for those lands. I think in Oregon we have some people who think that we're charging too much, and I have some people who think we're not charging enough. So we have a formula that's based on cattle prices and some other factors. It's not all that dissimilar from other formulas that are used by other states to set those rates.
Are you?
I'm done.
Okay. Representative Gerard.
Thank you. Louise, as most of us in Eastern Oregon are aware, the market value of land is determined by how much water and very little else, which makes it the market value extremely variable from year to year, depending on snowpack and actual rainfall. So that's a very difficult task that you have chosen, or a very tough part of the apple to take a bite of.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair and Representative Gerard, I think that's part of the reason we use a formula that gets us to a fee that everybody pays. And it may not be the fairest way to assess fees, because some lands, there is water. In many cases, that's because our lessee brought water to the land, not because we developed those water resources. The lessee is responsible for putting fences up if they want fences. We generally have not done that. So the improvements are generally the responsibility of the lessee.
Thank you.
Or Senator.
Thank you. How many acres do you actually own or control with this?
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, we own about 630,000 acres of rangeland and about another 5,000 acres of agricultural land, which is in growing crops as opposed to grazing.
So in comparison, that's really not very much of the land in the state, is it? I mean, we're...
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, that's correct.
65 million acres in Oregon. So you're...
If you actually controlled what was green on your map, you'd have a... your earlier map.
Mr. Chair, then we'd be talking some real revenue.
If you got two sections for every township, it seems like there should be a lot more land there.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, the original allocation was somewhere between $3.5 and $4 million, 4 million acres, not dollars. But over, we actually have a rather sordid history of disposal of those lands, including selling some of them, which we didn't own, among other things. But over a number of years and a variety of land sales, we do not hold the majority of the lands that we were originally granted at statehood.
I have a few more questions. One, you're within the document is a general number that actually we'll get into that later that shows up actually as a performance measure. It uses the figure 38%. Is that to be the sort of the broad estimate of what it costs to manage all of your resources?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And so total operating expenses as a percentage of our total revenues is 38%. That is in large part in the Land Management Division driven by a contract that we have with the Department of Forestry to manage our forest land. Those expenses tend
to
run.
That was about $12 or $13 million, I think, in this
Mr.
budget.
Mr. Chair, we're for this biennium at about $11.1 million. Next biennium, slightly less than that in their governor's recommended budget. Those costs right now as a percentage for the Department of Forestry contract as a percentage of our revenues are running close to 50%, which is a bit abnormal. Normally they run in the 30 to 35% range, and that's because our revenues are down as a result of harvest being down, and that's because we are managing for murrelets under a take avoidance strategy, which means we survey for them and then we manage to avoid them. and that has put a large amount of the forest off limits to harvest. We're working on a habitat conservation plan to get us out of this survey and manage routine, which we believe will allow us to increase the harvest off of that forest and get our revenues back up and sustainable over the next 60 years.
I had a question about the Superfund site also in the Portland Harbor. Sort of a broad question, but let me give you a little bit of background in terms of where I'm coming from. When I was on the Metro Council, we sited what that was then called, I think they've changed the name, the Metro Central Transfer Station in the Northwest Industrial Area. To one side of the site that we selected was a defunct Roan Polunk plant that produced Agent Orange during the Vietnam War. To the other side was Gold Battery Company, which up until the 1970s had actually thrown battery casings into the shallow lake that was behind the company. To the other side was a tank farm for one of the petroleum companies that had routinely, up until several decades ago, cleaned out its tanks by basically dispersing whatever was left in the sediment in the bottom of the tanks, petroleum sediment, onto the ground. And to the other side was the only sort of semi-clean site that we found, which was a company that actually produced various industrial gases. We went through literally probably $750,000 in analysis to try to determine that the site that we were on had never produced anything that contaminated the ground. And we did find that it was simply had always been a steel warehouse, never produced steel, never produced anything. We capped this entire site so that we could not be accused in the future of ever having contributed to anything on the site. We also probably got to learn more about the history of that area than wanted to know either, in that most of it actually was former wetlands, and as the city of Portland developed, was all filled in. My underlying question is, knowing what some of the history is in that site, and that's only like a tiny example, and there actually could be other areas along some of our waterways that have similar examples beyond that. What is the state's underlying liability to clean up the sites, the waterway portion of them, the submerged portion of them, if we can't find other ways to do it?
Mr. Chair, that would be the $64 million question.
That might be on the low side.
Mr. Chair, I think that's correct. Mr. Chair, that's a complicated question with a complicated answer. There is potential that the state has liability, is a potentially responsible party as a result of our leasing activities, and it's not just the Department of State Lands. There are other state agencies who own lands in the Superfund site area, including ODOT and ODFW and maybe others, which is why we are all working with the Lower Willamette Group, which are the PRPs, the potentially responsible parties that have come forward early to fund the feasibility study and remedial investigation. There is now a sort of secondary set of companies called the Blue Water Group that are negotiating with the Lower Willamette Group to maybe broaden that group. There's been an effort in this Superfund cleanup to get as many of the potentially responsible parties in the room early in this process and paying for the feasibility study and the other work that's being done, the natural resource damage assessment that's part of that process also. And I think until we get done with the feasibility study remedial investigation and start looking at the alternatives, putting some number on, you know, how much of the contaminant is the state responsible for versus other parties there, I think we don't know yet, and we're not likely to know for a couple of years, and then trying to calculate the cost of the cleanup. I've heard numbers that range from, you know, in the hundreds of millions for the total cleanup to even beyond that. I think we're too early in the process to be able to answer many of those questions.
Thank you. Are there any additional questions, or we'll go on to performance measures? And what I'd like to do is we'll probably go for about 15 minutes through performance measures. I don't want you to complete them in 15 minutes necessarily.
Okay.
But we'll probably go as far as we can go in 15 minutes, see if there's some more questions. Then we'll start up with the remainder of the performance measures tomorrow.
Okay, great.
That would pretty much keep us.
So, as I indicated, we've gone through significant changes to our key performance measures in the interim. This overall chart that you have is based on our key performance measures that we came out of the 2005 session with. So this is based on the 29 that we had. On the key performance measures where we were making progress, we had 43%. The key performance measures where the progress is unclear, it's because in many cases they were new performance measures in 2005 and we only have a year or so of data, so we don't have a trend yet to look, we didn't have a trend yet to look at, and many of those are now proposed to be deleted or altered in some way. So we're trying to get trends on our key performance measures has been a little bit difficult because of the amount of change that we've made. And then we have about 18% of those where it's clear that we were not making progress, and we'll talk about those. Okay. So, first key performance measure, and these are the key performance measures that were approved by the Joint Legislative Audit Committee in November of 2006. And the first one is one that is not changed, and that is the percent annual increase in revenues to the Common School Fund from all of our agency activities. You'll notice that our target was over $16 million in 2006, and we missed that target, and that's directly related to the forest revenues being down in the Elliott State Forest because of the Endangered Species Act listings that we've got in the forest and needing to manage for those in the absence of a habitat conservation plan. I think probably a little bit of good news that's built within that. Our forestry revenues went down by more than $4 million, and so it shows that revenues in our other programs have gone up somewhat and have made up somewhat for the loss of forestry revenue. Our 2007 target and going out is to see the increase in our revenues going up by 1.5% each year, and we've just converted that to dollar figures so it's easier to track. Our second performance measure is the percent annual increase in the amount of unclaimed property reported and remitted annually. This language has changed from our previous performance measure for unclaimed property, which was the percent increase in the number of holders they're reporting. And so we've now converted this to the dollar amount that's coming in and the increase in that. The actual in 2006 was just about $33.5 million, and our target for 2007 is $34.5 million, and we are engaged in a number of outreach and education efforts that has been resulting in significant increases in reporting over the last several years, and we expect to see that continue to grow. There's a bill in this session that would put gift guards in the mix, which has the potential to significantly increase the revenues that would come into the program each year should that bill pass. And once again, the goal is to increase the amount of money that's coming in from unclaimed property each year by 3%. Our third performance measure is the percent change in our net operating income for our Common School Fund land assets. So this deals with the real estate portfolio, and these are key performance measures that are tied directly to the asset management plan. You'll notice that there's a significant miss in 2006, and this is directly related to the forestry revenues being down significantly from what we had hoped would happen. We do expect to see those revenues go up in the 2007-2009 biennium. In 2005-2007, our total revenues from the Common School Fund forest lands should hit right around $22 million. Our projection for next biennium is that will be up to about $31 million. So we expect that to go back up as we're adjusting our harvests to deal with the ESA listed critters in the forests that we've got. And again, the goal is to see an increase in those revenues coming from our real estate assets by 3% a year. I will say this, as we start to bring on some of the industrial, commercial, residential opportunities that we see over the next 5 to 10 years, we expect to see that that portion of the real estate portfolio will start to generate significantly more revenues into the common school fund than it does right now. We're pretty much the revenues that come from industrial, commercial, residential is the rent that we get from other agencies who rent space in our building from us. Our fourth key performance measure is the percent change in the total annual revenue from our real estate assets, and this is the gross number. The KPM3 is after our expenses are taken out. Once again, you can see this, the significant miss, and once again tied directly to our missed revenue targets for our forest lands. Our next KPM is for our states program. This is the percent annual increase in the net revenue that comes in from escheated estates. And just a reminder, the Department of State Lands serves as the administrator for estates. When people die with no known heirs nor a will, and we manage the estates for those folks. We hold on to those resources for 10 years, and they are available for claim by rightful heirs. If after 10 years no rightful heir shows up, that money is escheated to the Common School Fund permanently, and the revenues from those resources are available for distribution to the schools. So this number reflects the amount of estate dollars that have hit that 10-year point and actually escheated into the Common School Fund permanently. And we're a little bit below our target for 2006. I will say this, our estates program is starting to take off in leaps and bounds. We've been running about two or three estates a week, and then it's increased to 4 to 5 late last year, and this year we're running about 8 a week, and that's part as a result of outreach efforts that our staff are doing to make folks in all the counties of the state aware. We had estate staff go over to Bend to handle a single estate, and by the time they came home, they had 12 more that they were dealing with. So the outreach effort is starting to show some significant increases in that program. So over time, there is the potential for this number to grow significantly as well.
Karen?
Yes.
An amount of money is enough to make a huge difference, I guess. I just find it very interesting. What happens to those properties if you don't find them?
Mr. Chair and Senator Avakian, if somebody dies and they owned a house, for instance, we actually sell those at auction. We sell cars on eBay and at
auction.
What
happens if you don't find the properties? Does the does the county assume the land, or is the court doing something with it?
Mr. Chair and Senator Avakian, so are you asking me if somebody dies and nobody notifies us, we're not aware that...
Yeah, you said you went out and you found 12, came back with 12 others. If you hadn't gone out and come back with the 12 others, what would the 12 others be doing now?
Mr. Chair and Senator Avakian, in some cases, neighbors handle it, friends. So there's a number of ways that things get taken care of.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Interesting. I find it really interesting because the state can really make a clean sweep if we smoke more, if we gamble more, if we drink more, and then die without a will. It's a clean sweep for the state all the way through.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Garrard, I don't know that I want to advocate that we go there.
No, but if you want to, Representative Garrard, you may have some followers. You might. I don't know.
Well, since I allowed this diversion to begin here, I'll keep it up. I was a little bit surprised by these numbers, actually, because I saw the numbers as being relatively small, given the number of people that I think that might pass without a will. And I know that many people actually probably do not have very much in assets, but at the same time, I still find the number relatively small.
Mr. Chair, I think I'd agree with that. You have to remember these are 10-year-old estates that we're talking about at this point. Many times the estates that we're going into are people who were, in some cases, destitute. The values of the estates may not be very much. The estates program was a very small component of one was part of the unclaimed property section at one point. Focus was not on the estates program. We've now it's its own program within the fiscal section. We've gotten additional staff in this biennium in the interim through the emergency board so that we can really begin an outreach and education program. I think many people were not aware that the program existed, and so we're trying to make people more aware. Right now, today, we're handling estates that are valued at about $6 million, so we're starting to see that growth occur, and I expect us, particularly in Eastern Oregon, as Pamela, who's the estates manager, used to say, nobody in Oregon dies in Eastern Oregon dies without a will or an heir because we never were getting estates. And I think part of it is they just weren't aware that we are the administrator for those estates and that we have a program to administer those estates. We also, if there is a will and there's an heir that can't be located, we are also responsible for administering those funds until the heir can be located. So we also have a number of those assets that are a part of this program as well.
One additional follow-up, Ms. Thalia, on that. Is there a... trying to understand this is 10 years after. Is there a sort of a de minimis amount where you're just allowed to just basically say that it isn't worth the effort of tracking or isn't worth the effort of...
I thought this would have been the point of interest of the of this budget.
No, Senator Devlin asked.
Chair Devlin, for the record, my name is Pamela Constantopoulos, and I'm the fiscal manager and the estate administrator for the Department of State Lands. Every estate that we get, we take a cost-benefit analysis, if you would. And so if we get someone who we know pretty much from the outset and from the evidence that we have is destitute, we do not put a lot of time into that estate. However, we do a cursory investigation to make sure there's not a bank account that we don't know about or some other assets that aren't out there waiting for us. Surprisingly enough, even some people that would appear on the surface to be destitute end up having a lot of money. For instance, we go into Section 8 housing and we find a trunk full of $30,000. So we always have to do the investigation. If we're satisfied that there's not the assets to warrant going further, we close it as insolvent.
I think most of us have heard of examples that are on both sides of that. People that appear destitute that actually have a considerable amount of assets, and people who appear well off that are actually destitute. When you
What about property outside of the state that is abandoned because there are no heirs? Is there a way to get at that?
Chair Devlin, Representative Nolan, we very often get estates that have property. Sorry.
No, that's okay. I moved. But you see, Representative Nolan is the co-chair, and so I was hoping somebody would make that mistake on the record.
There you go. We thought she had lost
me. I knew that. You got me. We very often get estates that have property in other states. And when we know of those, we contact real estate agents and do what's necessary to liquidate and capture those assets as well.
Is there a cooperative structure between the states so that you have the authority to reach outside of our borders? Or I'm curious how that works. That could...
Chair Devlin, Representative Nolan, if the person died in or sorry.
It is a
vacuum. As long as the person died in Oregon and was a resident of Oregon, we have the authority to act on any assets of the state. There are some states in some cases where we do need to be appointed in that state respectively to act, for instance, California being one of them. But there is a mechanism in place where we can be sure and capture everything that the person had, regardless of where it is.
Sorry for the 10-minute diversion, Mr. Chair. I found it very interesting. Yeah.
Well, we'll go back to the normal presentation. Thank you very much. And I guess we are on...
Performance measure six.
Six. And what we will do is we'll try to go through probably performance measure 11 today. And then tomorrow we'll go through the rest of the performance measures. And probably if you could also bring in, and when we get to the end we'll go back and look at what the targets are for the coming biennium for each of these performance measures. Because I don't know, your 2007 is not actually your complete target, is it, for that?
Mr. Chair, it's
08 and 09.
We have
okay.
on the form itself in the section. Yeah.
Okay. And if you could just... We could just go through those tomorrow also, and so, but we'll try to get through 11 today. I think we'll be done before you get back. So.
Okay, key performance measure 7 is the percent of our revenue used to cover administrative and operational costs for the revenue-generating programs. And this is a roll-up of a number of individual key performance measures that we had last biennium, which actually called for us to, and we will actually generate this information, to do this by land class so we could see for forestry lands, for agricultural lands, for range lands, for submersible lands. So, and we will actually track for each of those land classes. But this is a roll-up of all of that information, and this is where the 38% target that you asked about earlier.
Okay, and just to clarify, that 38% is for the revenue-generating programs. It does not apply to the assets managed that are basically liquid, or not really liquid assets, but your investment income.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And it also does not include the costs of the regulatory program. This is really about our land management programs and the ones that we're trying to produce revenue from, as well as unclaimed property in the estates.
Please proceed.
Key performance measure 7 is the percent of DSL lands and waterways with completed resource inventories, and this is pretty important in order for us to get management plans in place. We need to have resource inventories completed. Our target for 2006 was to have 60% of those done, and we met that target, and we expect that we're going to increase the amount that's done by 5% each year. We are doing about 30,000 acres a year. This is what we use our three seasonal positions for, is to complete those. I might mention the Territorial Sea plan was not based on an inventory, and we don't have an inventory because it's something that's very difficult to inventory, which is everything from the low tide out to the 3-mile mark off the coast of Oregon, although there is some discussion about a seafloor mapping project, which would give us quite a bit of new inventory data for the Territorial Sea. And then the next one is tied directly back to the resource inventories, and that's the percent of our lands that actually have completed management plans in place. And you'll notice this number is higher than the ones with inventories, and that's the difference is the Territorial Sea area. We did not quite meet our target in 2006, but we have several of those planning efforts underway, particularly out in Central Oregon, that we believe will allow us to meet that target in 2007. And you'll also see as we look at the 2008 and 2009, the goal is to increase that until we have plans for all of our lands. Number nine is the percent change in wetland acreage due to permit actions. And so this is directly connected to our regulatory program. The state policy is we want to have no net loss of wetlands. And so the goal here is to have zero. That means that as a result of our permitting action, we are not losing wetlands, we are not gaining wetlands, we are no net loss. We do generally gain a little bit each year as a result of the mitigation that's done as a result of conditions on permits for removal fill activities. And we track this separately for freshwater and estuarine mitigation requirements. Estuarine wetlands are in very small supply these days and very valuable in terms of fisheries resources, and so we do track the data separately from the freshwater system and the saltwater systems. And the target is always zero. That is, we don't want our permitting activities to result in any change. It's, it should be a net gain of zero, a net loss of zero as a result of our permit actions. There are other things that may happen that may cause the number of acreage to grow or decline, but this is tied directly to what we do. Key performance measure 10 is the percent of our removal fill violations resolved within a year. We had a similar measure. It didn't require us to resolve them within a year. It just was sort of an open-ended. And so we put some timeline on this to get us better working in terms of actually trying to resolve those issues sooner rather than later. We've got some cases that have had violation files open for a long time that have not been resolved, and we're working on getting those resolved. You'll see that we missed the target quite significantly in 2006. I think you'll see some improvement in 2007 and beyond as we're working to clean up some of those old cases and also to deal with our violations and enforcement cases a little differently than we have in the past. So hopefully we'll see some improvement in that area. And then last one you want me to cover today is Key Performance Measure 11, and this is the rate of compliance with our removal fill permit conditions, and this is a key performance measure that we've had for a while. We have targets both for our wetland areas and our non-wetland areas, and you can see that we're out of compliance or not meeting our targets on the wetland area. And we are meeting our target on the non-wetland area. We do have some staff as a result of some EPA grants, Environmental Protection Agency grants that we've gotten that are working to get us in better compliance with our wetland piece of that. And so I hope that you're going to see some improvements in 2007 and beyond on that one also. With that, I'll take any questions on...
Representative Garrard.
As Louise is aware, this is a very contentious key performance measure in my particular area, and I've got another one with the rip rock problem of somebody pulling rocks off the bottom of the lake and filling in front of their home and then being charged for taking that rock off the lake bottom to fill in the front of their home. It's really a difficult situation to make the property owner understand what, in essence, they are doing. And as we investigated, at one time we found that it was supposed to be acknowledged to the property owner at the time they purchased the property, but rarely is. So there's really a big effort here to educate the public so that they can better understand what this is all about, because most of them just don't comprehend what we're doing to them.
Mr. Chair and Representative Garrard, a couple things. I think the removal fill statutes are very complicated, as are our rules. And one of the things that I have on our to-do list in the interim is really to do a top-to-bottom review of our statutes and rules and see if there are things that we can do to make those statutes and rules more understandable to the public and more streamlined for the public. When I first went to the Department of State Lands, you know, I spent eight years in the governor's office, and I can honestly say I spent very little time reading ORSs. But when I went to the department, I realized I probably needed to read the ORSs that directed the agency's work. And if I was an agricultural landowner out there, I would have a very difficult time if I was sitting down reading the statutes and the rules, figuring out what I can and can't do with regard to removal fill on my lands. And we've, I think, evidence of that is we've actually put together a little chart that explains it for staff and landowners to try and simplify it, because it's very difficult to understand. And I think we are trying to do a better job of educating the public about our processes and our rules. We're making all of our information available on our website to folks so that they can go, and whatever our staff are using as they're making permit decisions, the public's got access to, they know what the criteria are, and so I think we're getting better at that, and we can continue to make improvements there.
One final comment, Mr. Chair. Even the length of a dock plays a role in how much the fee is charged.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, that's correct. One of the ways to simplify that is to get rid of all the exemptions and just make everybody pay a fee.
Well, Representative Garrard, even in my neck of the woods, I would have a lot of issues with people if that was the decision.
Yeah.
Any additional questions at this point? Ms. Holliday, tomorrow, how far would you hope to get through?
Mr. Chair, I would expect to be into our program option package discussions. I don't expect we've got six more performance measures to go through, and I just want to talk about the proposed change. And then I was not planning to spend a whole lot of time on the priorities, reductions, and efficiencies, spend most of the time talking about the efficiencies, the rest of the material you've got, and then dive into the program option packages.
And if you would bring tomorrow the targets for the performance measures through this coming biennium, that would be helpful. I know that they're in your budget document also, but just so that the committee members could follow along here. So
okay, yeah, and just so you know that they are in the key performance measure section.
Oh.
Starting on page 5, you can actually see the targets going out to 2009 for each of them.
Okay.
So they are.
Well, that should be sufficient, actually, if they're in that. I just didn't want them trying to look through this book.
Yeah, no, it's in this. Yeah, that's why we put them in here, so that you could see them right in here.
Okay.
There are some missing ones.
Which we've added to the back end. All right, so they are there.
Okay. We were in a committee the other day, and they were trying to basically change in and change out sections during the committee hearing,
yeah.
And it didn't really work very well.
Right.
So with that, we're adjourned for today, and we'll start promptly at 8:30 tomorrow morning.
Great. Thank you.
See you all back then.
Thank you.